It was a January sunny day, and I'm just sitting in the kitchen, and I'm thinking, wow, so this is what it's like to fail.
Oil industry layoffs hit home for Alaskans. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, July 5th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a massive landslide near Glacier Bay.
A 4,000-foot face of a mountain falls off and shoots itself 6 miles out across the glacier. That's pretty spectacular.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Boating accidents happen even to experienced boaters and even on calm, sunny days. This boating season, make your friends and loved ones promise to always wear a life jacket and carry emergency communication and distress signaling devices. Visit pledgetolive.org where you can file a float plan, get marine weather forecasts, and download a pre-departure checklist. This message sponsored by the Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
For the first time in nearly 30 years, Alaska is in a recession. With oil prices at half their recent peak, the state has shed more than 2,000 jobs in the energy industry since this time last year. That means many Alaskans are adjusting to a new reality: lost paychecks, unexpected career changes, and the possibility they might have to leave the state entirely. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rachel Waldholtz reports.
It's a sunny afternoon in downtown Anchorage, and there's a late lunchtime rush at the sandwich shop Urban Greens.
Half turkey, no mayo, no onion, no tomato. Is that for you?
Behind the counter is a young woman in red flannel and big glasses. She seems to know the names of half the people walking through the door and their usual lunch order.
Hey, Dave. What's going on? I'm good. How are you?
Rachel Mills is the manager of Urban Greens, but 6 months ago, she had a very different job. As a botanist for ASRC Energy Services, an oil and gas contractor. When Shell announced it was pulling out of the Arctic last fall, it hit her company hard. A few months later, right around the time oil plunged to a 12-year low, Mills was told she no longer had a job.
It was a January sunny day, and I'm just sitting in the kitchen, and I'm thinking, wow, so this is what it's like to fail.
That same month, the state, one of the few other employers for a botanist, announced a hiring freeze as low oil revenue prompted budget cuts.
I mean, I have all this education. I did everything by the book. I worked really hard. I got the job. Everyone likes me. I'm working hard, and it doesn't matter.
Mills isn't alone. She's part of a wave of Alaskans who have lost work in the last year as the state has seen its first real dip in jobs in nearly three decades. According to state economist Neil Fried, with the exception of a brief slowdown in 2009 when the Great Recession hit tourism, Alaska has seen economic growth every year since 1988, until now.
This is an interruption of that, yes. So we are, I think we will define this possibly as a new period. The question is how long of a period.
A new period defined by low oil prices. In some ways, the downturn came late to Alaska. The price of oil started dropping in the summer of 2014, and the bust hit states like North Dakota soon after. But in Alaska, employment held steady. The state actually gained oil and gas jobs through the beginning of 2015. Fried says those gains built on a remarkable period for the state, as oil prices drove industry job numbers to record highs.
2014, which was not very long ago, was the largest oil industry workforce we have ever had in our history, which is pretty phenomenal when you think that we're producing a quarter of as much oil as we were during our peak.
In fact, Alaska still has historically high numbers of people working in oil and gas, more than 12,000. And Fried worries those record highs might mean record losses. Since last May, the state is down about 2,100 jobs in the industry, and those numbers likely don't include people like Mills, who is a botanist working for a contractor. Related fields like engineering and construction have also shed workers. Alaska has gained jobs in other areas, like healthcare and retail, but Fried says it's not the same.
Those are hard jobs to replace. You know, it's not like the, you know, closing down Sports Authority.
That's in part because of the pay difference. Fried says oil and gas jobs pay more than 2.5 times the average in other industries. Brad Campbell is facing that reality. He worked as a financial analyst at BP for more than 15 years until he was laid off in June.
2 years in a row, I went through uncertainty. Am I going to have a job or not? I'm kind of relieved I don't now. At least I know. You know, I can move on to different things.
Campbell would like to stay in oil and gas. And right now, he says, he's doing everything possible just to hang on to his home.
And I'm a little worried about, you know, getting a job that pays well, but I'm just going to have faith it's going to work out.
Above all, he says, he'd like to stay in Alaska, where he's lived since 1983. So would Rachel Mills. When her husband mentioned a sandwich shop that needed a manager, she jumped at it, even though it came with a major pay cut and no benefits. She's even using her degrees. Sort of.
All right, here we are. Welcome to the basement. This is always creepy to say, hi, come see my basement.
Urban Greens is experimenting with a hydroponic operation. In its basement is a sort of mini jungle of basil and lettuce.
So here is our operation. It is three bays with 15 trays each.
I asked Mills if she could, would she go back in time and undo her layoff?
I would undo my layoff if we had work. But if it was still the same situation with oil and gas the way it is right now, I would absolutely not undo it because it was agony. You know, you're just standing around knowing there's nothing to work on. You're worried about everyone. And who wants to work in this moribund environment where at any moment we're all going to be without jobs?
That's the uncertainty facing many people around the state as they wonder how long this new period will last and whether the end is in sight or if this is just the beginning. From Alaska's Energy Desk, with help from Eric Keto, I'm Rachel Waldholz in Anchorage.
That story came to us from Alaska's Energy Desk, a new collaboration between Alaska Public Media in Anchorage, KTOO in Juneau, and KUCB in Unalaska. You can find more stories from this series, An Uncertain Future, online or on Facebook. Search for Alaska's Energy Desk. A massive landslide, estimated to be around 6.5 miles long near Glacier Bay, has scientists in New York clamoring to get to southeast Alaska. The slide happened last week and was discovered by a pilot. KHNS's Jillian Rogers has more.
On Tuesday morning, when Paul Swanstrom saw the dust cloud hovering over the Lamplugh Glacier, he says he knew exactly what it was.
Because we've seen these landslides before. Now, I've made the air a little dusty there, but it's not any danger now.
This landslide in Glacier Bay National Park, like the ones in 2014 and 2012, sent millions of tons of debris spilling down the mountainside. According to the Alaska Earthquake Center, it happened at 8:21 a.m. Swanstrom flew over it 2 hours later. Tuesday's slide toppled down the glacier for approximately 6.5 miles, though the official size is still unknown. But early estimates rival the giant Glacier Bay slides in the past several years. It may have even been the biggest yet.
The other one, a couple of 4 years ago, that was really big, went down about 4 miles, 4.5 miles, and it was in a little narrower of a canyon. This thing is a little longer and much bigger in many ways.
The recent avalanche happened about 8 miles from those big slides that excited scientists in the recent past, Swanstrom says, and about 60 or so miles from Haines.
This is a very important event.
Colin Stark is a research professor with the Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University. He's getting ready to fly to Juneau and head to the site to gather sediment samples in the coming days. Measurements and samples will give Stark and his team a better understanding of why the slide happened and how exactly it traveled to its final resting place.
We have events like this maybe 3 to 5 times per year across the entire world. And the St. Elias Range and Glacier Bay, southeast Alaska in general, are hotspots in terms of rock avalanches, very large landslides.
The reason, he says, is that mountains in southeast are growing at an accelerated rate because of shifting tectonic plates.
So mountains are being built very fast, and they're also being destroyed very fast because the rocks are weak and because glacial erosion is very powerful.
The result is an extraordinary amount of rock avalanches of impressive magnitudes. From his initial data, Stark thinks this slide likely had a mass of around 150 million metric tons, a world-class event, he says. As far as the force of the slide, it was 280 giganewtons, which, let's face it, is meaningless to most of us. So Stark tried to put it in a context better grasped by the average person.
I think a small SUV weighs about a ton. I'm not very good on the, you know, real world things, obviously. I'm an academic. What do I know? You know, 100 million cars falling down a slope.
Stark says the abundance of these slide events in Glacier Bay is concerning because of the cruise ship traffic and remote lodges scattered throughout the area.
And in fact, these rock avalanches do seem to occur more in summertime, possibly related to warmer summer temperatures, although that's a little hard to say. They don't happen often enough for us to be able to generalize yet. But yeah, this is a very serious event. It's probably, I want to say, one of the largest in the last few decades.
Stark and his fellow researchers detect large slides with the help of long-distance seismometers. They knew about this one, quote, very quickly after the slide let loose.
So we can be based in New York and look at the local and global seismographic network. And my colleague has an automatic system for detecting regular earthquakes based on these instruments that are spread around the globe. But occasionally, these seismometers pick up a very, very large landslide.
Haynes geologist Russ White flew over the slide the day after it happened. He says earth-moving events like this happen fairly frequently.
Geologically speaking, they happen all the time, which, you know, 2 in 4 years is probably fairly frequent. But mountains are eroding constantly, and this is just one of the forms of erosion. It's a fairly spectacular form of erosion when a 4,000-foot face of a mountain falls off and shoots itself 6 miles out across the glacier. That's pretty spectacular.
Over the weekend, the Alaska Earthquake Center compiled data on the landslide and say it was the equivalent to a magnitude 5.5 earthquake. State seismologist Michael West says the signals from the slide were clear all the way up to Barrow, across to Nome, and beyond. He says this slide, quote, shook a decent amount of our planet. Reporting in Haines, I'm Jillian Rogers.
The search has been suspended for a Nome man missing for more than a week. Alaska State Troopers say they've ended the search for 36-year-old Joseph Balderas, pending any new leads. The search for Balderas began after he failed to show up for work on June 27th at his job as a law clerk in the Nome court. Balderas' vehicle was found along the Nome Council Highway, and Alaska State Troopers say he may have been mountain running or hiking off the road. In a web post today, troopers say the intensive 7-day search involving multiple agencies turned up no evidence of his location. Anchorage police are ruling homicide in the deaths of two people found on a city bike path early Sunday morning. APD has identified the victims as 20-year-old Brianna Fosse and 41-year-old Jason Netter Sr. Law enforcement is not releasing any further details on the cause of death, nor is anyone in custody at this time. The two deceased were found by a passerby at about 7:42 a.m. on Sunday on the path which runs through an industrial warehouse area about a mile from a popular downtown fishing spot. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, debate in the Kenai Peninsula Borough over property tax exemptions for seniors.
I see it as a great incentive to get seniors to stay here year-round. They're all through the winter. They volunteer.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future that delivers oil today and sustains operations for tomorrow. The Arctic is wild, remote, and untouched. See how contemporary artists challenge the mythical ideal of the North in the Anchorage Museum exhibition, View from Up Here, the Arctic at the Center of the World, on view through October the 2nd. This message sponsored by the Anchorage Museum.
4 beaches in the Juneau Douglas area have elevated levels of toxins that can cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. Eagle Beach, Amalga Harbor, Auk Recreational Area, and Outer Point all have toxin levels that exceed the Food and Drug Administration's limit for safe consumption. Elizabeth Tobin is a postdoctoral researcher. She and her team collected the data last month. She says it's not abnormal to see high levels of PSP causing toxins this time of year.
Typically, we see elevated levels of these toxic algae in May and June, and that's why we're having a lot of PSP notifications in the region.
Tobin is a researcher for the University of Alaska Fairbanks School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences. They collaborated with the Southeast Alaska Tribal Toxins Network, which published the advisory on its website. Tobin's team tests areas around Juneau and Douglas weekly. She says the only way to know if shellfish is toxic is to conduct lab tests. There are no testing facilities in the region that check non-commercial catches.
It's very, very difficult to tell or to taste or to, you know, eat a small bit and see if you feel funny. That's kind of gambling a little bit. So while some people, you know, that's the method they use, I tend not to recommend that. It's not safe.
Sometimes people associate unsafe areas for collecting shellfish only in places with red tides caused by certain algal blooms.
But it's kind of misleading, actually. And specifically for the algae, it's called Alexandrium, that produces the saxitoxins that cause paralytic shellfish poisoning. Kind of a mouthful. But that particular species of algae, it doesn't produce a red discoloration of the water.
Tobin says that's why the advisories are helpful. A link to information about shellfish monitoring in Southeast is at our website, alaskapublic.org. The Central Council of Tlingit and Haida Indian Tribes of Alaska is doing something few tribal organizations do. In June, the tribe acquired Kira Incorporated, an international maintenance contracting company. The Colorado-based entity has scored more than $1 billion in federal contracts, according to its documents. KTOO's Lakhidra Chavis has the story.
Southeast Alaska's largest tribal organization wants to boost revenue with its acquisition. Tlingit Haida President Richard Peterson says the ultimate goal is to serve all of their tribal members, and not just those in Southeast.
You know, it feels somewhat disingenuous to continually say, oh, I'm sorry, you live outside of our service area, but hey, you're a citizen, thank you, you know.
Grant money that Tlingit Haida receives mostly limits its services to Southeast. The tribe provides educational, employment, elderly, and financial assistance for its tribal members. Peterson says half of the tribe's more than 33,000 members live elsewhere in the state, or Seattle.
There's a misconception out there that we generate funds based on our general enrollment, and we don't. We only generate funds based on the service area enrollment. So it's not like we get money on behalf of 30,000 members, and then we only give it to half. That's not the case.
In recent years, Tlingit Haida has made an active push to generate unrestricted funds by creating a separate company, Tlingit Haida Tribal Business Corporation, or THTBC. Last year, the Small Business Administration certified the company for special government contracting status under its 8A program. Alaska Native corporations have long used the program to win federal contracts, but it may be unusual for tribes to. Congress created the 8A certification decades ago to help small and minority-owned businesses win federal contracts. Special provisions were added in 1986 for federally recognized Native American and Alaska Native organizations. They can outgrow small status, but continue to enjoy the program's benefits. Carlos Garcia is Kira's founder and president. It was once 8A certified too, but outgrew the program. Now Kira will have those small business opportunities again, and in turn, more contracts.
We were only allowed to compete on a small percentage of them, and the clients wanted us to bid and, you know, apparently liked us, and we wanted to bid, but the only thing that was missing was we didn't have the certifications that the tribe enjoys. That's why this is such a win-win for everybody.
THTBC's acquisition of Kira became official after about a year of negotiations. Kira was actually looking for an Alaska Native Corporation partner, according to company documents from 2014. Garcia says he decided to sell to Tlingit Haida instead of an Alaska Native Corporation to ensure the profits directly benefited shareholders.
The money that we make is going to go straight to their tribal members in terms of programs. It's many of the large ANCs have these enormous bureaucracies in Anchorage, and the first people that get paid are those executives, and there doesn't always seem to be a lot of profits to put towards the native programs.
THTBC's CEO, Richard Reinhart, wouldn't disclose the acquisition price or the projected revenue from the purchase, but he says one of the goals is to have Kira compete in Alaska's market.
Kira has not competed a lot in Alaska because there are so many Alaska-based corporations that have an advantage from being Alaska-based. Well, now they'll be able to.
In the coming weeks, Garcia says Kira will add on multiple new contracts. He believes that if everyone works hard, the company and its profits will multiply quickly. In Juneau, I'm Lakhidra Chavis.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Apollo MT by Guardian Flight, Medevac memberships that protect you or a family member when there is a need for air medical transportation. Information available at apollomt.com.
It's summer and time to get out on the water, whether you're commercial fishing, heading to a weekend cabin, or tossing in a line to catch tonight's dinner. Having a boat means regular maintenance projects, fueling, and cleaning. Alaska Clean Harbors reminds you to minimize waste and pollution during these activities. Ask your harbor master for waste disposal information. Find more at alaskacleanharbors.org. This message sponsored by Cook Inlet Keeper with funding from the Coastal Impact Assistance Program.
As the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly works its way through proposed changes to the tax codes, the idea to phase out the senior property tax exemption has garnered the most public comment. KBBI's Jenny Nyman has more.
The Kenai Peninsula has become a magnet for senior citizens, and now that state cuts are putting pressure on local government, those seniors are being targeted to share more of the borough's financial burden through property taxes. Terry Wilson of Kenai will soon be one of them, and she is concerned.
This exemption will not affect me for a couple of years down the road, but I did build a house in that market value, thinking this was going to be available. I would hate to lose it.
Wilson testified about the issue before the Kenai Peninsula Borough Assembly at its June 21st meeting in Soldotna. Currently, between the state's $150,000 senior exemption and the borough's $150,000 senior exemption and $50,000 residential exemption, seniors on the Kenai don't pay taxes on $350,000 in property value. That's more than anywhere else in the state, says Assemblymember Gary Knopp.
We are the only borough in the entire state that offers the optional $150,000. Even with the exemption, the optional goes away, there's still that $200,000 exemption. I think it's still generous.
If passed, the ordinance would phase out the $150,000 exemption offered by the borough to seniors in 7 years, starting in 2018 and zeroing out in 2024. If the proposal goes through, seniors would still be eligible for the $150,000 exemption mandated by the state, which still comes out of the borough's pockets. Seniors on the Kenai would also still be eligible for the $50,000 residential tax exemption that the borough offers everyone. In addition, the borough would continue to offer its hardship provision, which limits a low-income senior's property tax bill to 2% of their annual household income. Public comment has largely been opposed to the measure.
I see it as a great incentive to get seniors to stay here year-round. All through the winter, they volunteer in hundreds, not only in our organization, but in many of the nonprofit organizations in our community.
That's Alan Humphreys, pastor at Soldotna Church of God. He noted particularly the work senior volunteers do at area hospitals. Several others have worried that losing the exemption would make it difficult for some seniors to make ends meet. Here's Priscilla Mott, who lives near Soldotna.
The seniors, they have a fixed income. Most of them do not have a great retirement. I think that the senior exemption really does encourage a lot of longtime Alaskans to stay here, and they are a benefit to our community.
Borough Mayor Mike Navarre points out, though, that with the senior population rising on the peninsula, continuing to offer such a large exemption to seniors in effect shifts the tax burden to the younger population, who might also be struggling financially.
The senior population is growing at 10 times the rate of the regular population. So if we get to a point where we have 50% seniors, should the non-seniors pay twice as much in order to pay for the services for the seniors? Young families, single parent families also struggle and have significant needs that state law doesn't allow us to do an exemption for them.
The mayor's office has information available on the measure on its website. The measure would need to go to a public vote this fall to be enacted and has one more public hearing before the assembly will vote whether to put it on the ballot. That hearing will be at the July 26th assembly meeting in Soldotna. I'm Jenny Nyman.
Longtime Sitka resident Linda Bankin has been appointed to the six-member International Pacific Halibut Commission. Bankin, whose name has been under consideration for the international panel for some time, was appointed on June 22nd, shortly after the prior Alaska representative was fined for overfishing. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Linda Bankin has been at the center of some of the most important decisions in groundfish policy in the North Pacific. During her 9 years on the North Pacific Fisheries Management Council, the regulatory body overseeing fishing in federal waters offshore of Alaska, she was instrumental in banning bottom trawling in Southeast, and she was an architect of individual fishing quotas for halibut and black cod. The International Pacific Halibut Commission sets harvest limits for commercial fishermen across the Gulf of Alaska. Her appointment to the IPHC comes at a time when that organization also is rethinking its long-standing management policies.
So providing a risk analysis decision-making table to the public and to the commissioners, and letting the commissioners understand where the certainty is, where the risks are, and make educated, informed decisions around that rather than the scientists saying, here's your numbers for setting the quota.
Benkin has been the executive director of the Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association in Sitka for most of its history. She's been a strong proponent of science-based management, but she also understands that the IPHC is where science and politics sometimes meet.
It's important to follow the science and err on the side of conservation. There's certainly been frustration in our area, southeast, that quotas have been set significantly over recommended levels for British Columbia and by our neighbors there, while the commissioners have set much more conservative quotas in this area, despite the fact that all the indicators of stock recovery are strongest here.
Benkin is now one of six commissioners, three from the U.S., three from Canada, who determine the annual halibut harvest. They have an extensive organization and research staff behind them, based at the University of Washington in Seattle. Benkin's appointment is considered interim until it is actually confirmed by the sitting U.S. president, a process that has no predictable timeline. The IPHC has been in the news recently, not all of it good. Benkin's predecessor, Jeff Kaufman, resigned his appointment after agreeing to pay a shared fine of $49,000 with two colleagues for overfishing halibut in 2012. The fine was levied by the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Office of Law Enforcement. Kaufman and the two other men reportedly exceeded their combined quota by 10,000 pounds. Kaufman is a resident of Wasilla. He is the vice president of the Central Bering Sea Fishermen's Association. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Rachel Waldholtz and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Jillian Rogers in Haines, Lakeed Rashavis in Juneau, Jenny Nyman in Kenai, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
The Resource Basket is a training and technical assistance center helping rural communities support healthy, resilient, and culturally connected youth. Tribes and youth-serving organizations can request support, explore resources, and find opportunities at resourcebasket.org or call the team directly at 1-800-478-7227, extension 7396. This message sponsored by the Rural Alaska Community Action Program. Mount Edgecombe High School in Sitka encourages rural Alaska high school students to apply to be part of their 70-year legacy. With a rich curriculum from art to advanced engineering, over 10,000 alumni strong, 90% of their students go on to a four-year college or other post-secondary education. Explore your talents and develop your dreams at Mount Edgecombe High School. Apply online at mehs.us. This message sponsored by Mount Edgecombe High School.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.